The streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we want to follow up on a couple of themes that we've been talking about in recent weeks. Most importantly, the U.S. economy and its state, its condition as a result of recent developments here and the most recent statistics that are being released. And I also want to continue saying something about what we have talked about a couple times here with regard to the repo market. You know, kind of an arcane, strange topic, but from the monetary side, rather important, because the problems in the repo market, which I'll explain again, are indicative of the central banks losing control on the financial side. You know, the crisis 10 years ago was Lehman Brothers and shadow banks and subprime mortgages and derivatives, and we've talked about that. But this time around, it looks like it's going to come from a totally different direction, and the repo market may be flashing red signals in that regard. Well, we'll get back to that, what's behind that, and we'll provide some background so folks can understand a little bit of that very complex, esoteric market and why it's important. I want to say a few things today as well about the GM deal here, tentative deal, it looks like. General Motors and the United Auto Workers here, an important labor struggle going on. What does that really reflect? Will there be a ratification? What in general does that represent, whether it's voted up or down here? So those three topics, and then I want to get on to talking about the general meaning of my new book coming out next week called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, and what that all represents. Okay, so let's just jump right now into the U.S. economy itself. What's new here since the last couple shows? Well, as we've been saying for quite some time, the key sectors of the U.S. economy are dipping into negative territory. Manufacturing, of course, negative again last month. Contracting, when we say negative, we mean contracting. Or if we want to express it in terms of purchasing managers indexes, a number of less than 50 on the PMI for manufacturing reflects a contraction of manufacturing of the economy. So manufacturing in the U.S. is now clearly contracting for multiple months. And following, you know, the trend globally, manufacturing, we are in a global synchronized manufacturing recession around the world. That's pretty significant, and I don't think it's been given enough attention, you know, by business economists and the media and so forth. Of course, manufacturing isn't the entire economy. Today, in the advanced economies like the U.S., in particular, services of various kinds constitute an even greater percentage of global or U.S. economic output, GDP. Roughly, depends on what you include in services, between 70% of U.S. GDP is services. And the rest of the economy, 30% roughly, is manufacturing, business investment, and construction. Business investment is broken into categories of new plant and equipment, inventories, software, and some other structures. And if you look at construction, that too is divided into categories of commercial property. In other words, factories and hotels and resorts and different properties, commercial properties, office buildings, etc., and apartment buildings and housing, residential housing. So those three categories constitute construction: commercial property, apartment building, and residential housing. Okay, private housing. Well, if you look at construction, let's take each of these categories: manufacturing and industrial production. By the way, industrial production is manufacturing plus mining plus utilities production. Okay, that's manufacturing. Construction are those three categories I just mentioned. Business investment are the categories of plant and equipment, inventory, software. And if you look at that area of the U.S. economy, it's contracting across the board. 30% of the economy is contracting across the board. You know, I mean, industrial production, which is manufacturing, mining, and utilities. Construction, which is commercial property, apartments, and residences. And business investment, which is plant and equipment, inventories, and software, and this relatively new category I didn't mention called intellectual property, or IP. Okay, all of that is in contraction right now. Last month, September, manufacturing was down negative 0.5%. Again, pretty big drop for 1 month. Industrial production, which is manufacturing plus the other categories, is down almost 1%. And over the last year, it's 0.9% over 12 months, industrial production. 0.4% September and 0.9% over the year. So year over year, we have the first contraction in industrial production in the U.S. since 2016. You know, 2016, businesses kind of went on an investment strike here, hoping to influence the outcome of the election, which, of course, they did. And then construction, housing starts, which include apartments and private houses, down 9.4% over the past year. Okay, so we got a contraction going on in all the goods producing areas, 30% of the economy, or 32, 33, whatever. What's still holding up has been consumption. Now, consumption is driven by attitudes of consumers. One, secondly, by the amount of credit that they can get. Thirdly, about their jobs, where they got jobs and jobs are increasing, and are they getting wage increases? Well, the fact that consumer spending has been holding up until now has been the big argument being made by pro-business and politicians that, oh, the economy's hanging in there, right? As long as the consumer stays, that's good. And, oh, you know, it must be that jobs are increasing and wages are increasing because household consumer spending is increasing. Moderately, not much, but, you know, it's still positive. The other areas are negative. This one is still positive. Well, we got statistics last month that showed retail sales are now contracting. Retail sales are about half of all consumption, consumer spending. So it's a big, big area. And, you know, it's the core of consumer spending. And, you know, it's not just department stores that are in trouble because of changing structure. They're down more than 6% year on year, department store sales. But it's now also online sales, online retail, you know, which is supposed to be always booming, is now contracting as well. And, of course, big contraction in autos in part due to the auto strike, but not that much, I don't believe. I believe a lot more is now beginning to have an impact from the tariffs and the price increases. As I've mentioned before, J.P. Morgan Chase Research has indicated that as of July, the tariff hikes on China alone have resulted in $600 on average being sucked out of households and spending. Well, now with the new tariffs that are going in starting in September, it looks like, according to Chase, $1,000. So the tariff taken out of household income. So the tariffs are beginning to bite. And I think that was one of the reasons why Trump got together with the China delegation last week and said, okay, let's get a temporary agreement here. Well, we talked about that in depth last week. If you want my analysis of that mini deal, just check it out on the show, last week's Alternative Vision show. I also deal with it in greater detail, even the whole trade war, in my forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, Chapter 8, Trump's Neoliberal 2.0 Restoration Attempt. We'll talk about that shortly. Okay, so now this area, consumer spending, is beginning to look shaky. It's beginning to spill over. As I've said, you know, the goods producing side of the economy, manufacturing, production, business investment, construction, this is the driver of the economy. It ultimately drives what goes on the services side, because it drives jobs and income and so forth. So it's the most important sector. And with that contracting, it's impossible to assume that it won't eventually spill over to the services side. And we began to see that last month as well, when the PMI, remember the PMI, which is a statistic that says if it's below 50, it's contracting, if above 50, it's growing. Well, the services PMI decelerated rapidly last month. It was 56, clearly robust growth in services, but it fell to 52. That's a big drop in 1 month. Right? We'll see what the next month PMI for services is, whether the PMI for manufacturing continues to spill over to the PMI for services, which I think is now doing. So services are slowing rapidly. They're not negative yet, but they're slowing rapidly. Retail sales now contracting. All of the tariffs now hitting household pocketbooks. All of that portends negatively for the consumer side, consumer spending. Well, they say jobs are doing great, right? We're still adding jobs. Well, I talked about that in previous shows. The jobs that are being added are mostly part-time temp kind of jobs that people are taking on as second and third jobs out of desperation to keep their income up. Now, those at the very top of the employment structure, the wage structure, are doing well. The top 10% in the fast growth areas like tech and healthcare, they are getting decent raises. But that drives up the average in a false kind of a way, because most of the folks are not getting these wage increases. As other surveys I've talked about here on the show illustrate, well over half of the workforce got no raises whatsoever last year. Well over half. I think that was the PayScale survey, right? And then the bank rates survey showed that people are 48% are working second and third jobs. This is where the employment, I think, is coming from, except certain industries where there is still growth. Okay. The whole picture of wage increases is driving consumption is false, I think. What's driving consumption is a massive escalation in credit going on, particularly credit cards. Mm-hmm. Average balances on credit cards are up 8%. Average balance, $8,600. That's average. You know, everybody owning credit cards, tens of millions, on average owe $8,600. And they're paying, on average, a 17 to 19% interest charge on that. Credit card companies have raised their interest charge. They typically do this to build up a cushion before they see a recession coming, because credit cards then go bust and they got to absorb the losses. So I think they're doing that this year. You know, the credit card companies are boosting their charges. And, of course, that's taking even more money out of consumption going on. Another factor. Jobs. What about the job picture? Well, the fact is, in the last 3-4 months, we've been creating jobs at half the level that we did a year ago. And a lot of those are census jobs. In other words, preparing for the census, the 2020 census, the government's hiring tens of thousands of more workers, 40, 50,000 eventually. And that makes even these weak job numbers overestimated, in my opinion, because these jobs will go away after the end of this year. So, you know, wages aren't really rising. Job quality is very weak. And the job creation numbers in the last 3 months is the slowest in 7 years. And that's boosted by the census numbers. Well, that's not a very positive picture for the employment market and for the household consumer spending. You know, if jobs are the big driver, or credit cards, or wage increases, yeah, credit cards, wages, no. Jobs slowing rapidly. Services PMI slowing down. Tariffs beginning to hit. Retail sales now contracting. Well, everybody who's been touting the fact that, oh, the consumer is solid, the consumer balance sheet is solid and is going to hold us up, you know, and that what's going on the good side, you know, with manufacturing and production and construction and so forth, oh, well, that's not going to affect the consumer. Obviously, the consumer's still doing well, as if the two were decoupled. You know, as if the goods-producing side of the economy was decoupled from the consumer side. I don't know. I think that's all nonsense. You know, I think that's a way of trying to cover up the fact that the U.S. economy is slowing in its key sectors and that it's beginning to spill over now to other sectors, particularly services and consumption, household consumption. Yet we hear that, you know, the talking heads talk that. Now, I was just listening to a show today, an interview by the International Institute of Finance, a very important think tank, interviewing two big bankers, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon and this fellow, I forgot his name, from Morgan Stanley, I think, the other big, another big bank. And you know, they were pontificating here on the state of the economy, and we get Dimon actually spewing this nonsense that, the consumer balance sheet is doing well and consumption's holding up and should continue holding up. Yeah, okay, we have problems on management and business side, but that's mostly just driven by the trade war, et cetera, et cetera. They see a dichotomy between these two key sectors. I don't. I think it's inevitable that one will slow the other, and that inevitability is beginning to appear, in my opinion. Well, you know, you've got other independent macro researchers beginning to significantly lower the GDP for this third quarter and fourth quarter. It will come out fairly soon. Here for third and fourth quarter. Well, not for fourth quarter. We're just going into the fourth quarter. Look, you know, first quarter of this year, GDP 3.1%. And as I explained way back when, that was artificially boosted by an increase in production for trade purposes to get the goods out there before the tariffs began to really hit, and also inventory buildups, which would disappear, which they did. So 3.1% was kind of an aberration, and that turned out in the second quarter. Of course, GDP was only 2%, as I had predicted. Most of that held up, again, by consumers at that point. Third quarter, 1.4%. And then, of course, fourth quarter, we don't know. I've been predicting that we could get the commencement of the next recession in the fourth quarter, 2019. Well, why so? Look, if it's a positive GDP, that can't be a recession, right? Recession needs two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. That's the rule of thumb. Well, that's not what defines recession. Sorry. That's what the media and the press throw at you. But recessions are defined by this group of economists who are, you know, the stars of the economics profession, and they get invited to join this elite group called the National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER. It's the NBER economists who say whether we're in a recession or not. It's not whether you get two negative quarters of the GDP. In fact, you can get one negative quarter GDP and be in a recession if the NBER economists say so. And they did say so in 2001. It was only one quarter. You know, and they said we were in a recession. Well, it depends what these guys are going to say. And, of course, they say it 6 months after it's occurred. They don't predict it. The important thing is the NBER economists look at not just GDP, because there's a lot wrong with GDP as an accurate indicator of the economic health and growth of an economy. We won't go into all those. We've talked about it from time to time. Okay, well, what do they look at? Well, they look at retail sales. Should they continue to decline in the fourth quarter, right? They look at industrial production. Oh, well, that's contracting, and manufacturing at its core. They look at trade, and of course, we have a trade deficit that's reached historic levels. After 15 months of Trump trade war, we have the biggest trade deficit ever, $55 billion of deficit in August. And they look at employment. Of course, the problem is they look primarily at full-time employed. And that's the problem with a lot of these statistics. They're not paying enough attention, and they're not accurately recording the numbers, I believe, of part-time and temp employees. That's another problem with the statistic. So the point is they look at a whole bunch of economic indicators to decide, you know, are they all going south or mostly going south? Maybe it hasn't registered yet in GDP, but very clearly this is the trend in a whole number of key indicators, and therefore we're in a recession. Okay, so we'll see if my analysis here plays out sometime next spring with the NBER, and whether the fourth quarter here, you know, it could go either way. Okay, we could slip into a recession here, or we might not slip into a recession in the fourth quarter. But it's coming soon after that, if not. Because the trade thing is not being resolved. You see, the negative thing about the trade mini deal for the U.S. consumer is that the tariffs aren't removed. No. Trump is maintaining 25% tariffs on virtually all the goods, and 10% tariffs, 10 or 15% further, $160 billion going to hit in December. Well, none of that is going to prove positive for consumption if the tariffs remain. And by the way, that that deal can still blow up, that trade mini deal. You know, what did Trump really get for it? Well, what he got for it was a resumption of China buying U.S. farm products. He says 40, 50 billion, but he doesn't say over what period, how long, you know, is he going to take to ramp up the 40, 50 billion? The U.S., I think, is buying or China's buying a minimal $8 billion. They didn't stop altogether buying foreign products, but the average was like $17 billion. So okay, over the next year they might return to what was the average before, and maybe in the second year of this deal, $20 more billion. Well, there's your $40 billion. That doesn't sound to me like a real big boost in farm spending by the Chinese. It sounds more like a return to previous trends. What the U.S. Side did get was this 51% ownership of U.S. operations in China. The bankers really wanted that, and they're already implementing it. You see, they already began to implement it earlier this year because they knew it was coming one way or another. China had agreed on this a year ago. They had agreed to 51% ownership concession, then they agreed to buy more farm products a year ago. What Trump got was what was on the table in 2018. He didn't get anything new, but it makes it sound like it is, and it's not even signed off. It's going to maybe be signed off at the Asian Pacific Economic Council meeting there in Chile in November. Maybe he and Xi will sign off. Maybe not, because in the interim, the neocons and anti-China hardliners who don't want to deal with China may scuttle it again, just as they scuttled the deal, tentative deal in May 2019, and before that in May 2018. They may scuttle this one too. We'll see. Okay, for a deeper analysis of that, just go back and listen to last week's show. Okay, so that's my take on the latest situation in the U.S. economy right now. I want to next talk again about this repo market. Remember the repo market? We talked about that, I think, two shows ago. Repo is a short acronym for repurchase agreements. A little bit arcane for most to understand, but think of the repurchase agreement market where banks borrow money from each other, and it can be very short term or a little bit longer term. It could be overnight, it could be within a week, a month, whatever. They borrow money for each other, and they use U.S. treasuries, treasury bonds and bills, as collateral that they put up when they borrow from each other. So if there's not enough treasuries in the repo market, they can't borrow from each other as much. And if the supply of available money, capital to borrow, is kept low because there's not enough treasuries to back them up, well, then the price, i.e. the interest rate on the existing borrowing in the repo market, goes up. It's a supply and demand, as we'll see. Simple explanation here. Not enough treasuries, the price of repos overnight borrowing between banks shoots up. Well, that's what happened in September. Caught the Fed, Federal Reserve, totally by surprise. Instead of 2% rate, the repo rate escalated to 10% overnight. Well, that's a big problem, you see, because it means there's not enough liquidity in the system. Liquidity meaning money to buy and to borrow and loan by banks to each other. And if they don't have enough, then they hold back on lending to other non-bank businesses. Okay, so the explanations were at the time, they ran out of liquidity because the banks had to make tax payments at the end of September, and there were settlements on other bonds, and that reduced the supply money capital in the repo market and caused the rates to go up. Well, as I've said before, I think the supply side issue is more complicated than that, and you know, if the amount of treasuries are needed as collateral, if you're pulling treasuries out of the economy, that's a problem, isn't it? Well, that's what the Fed has been doing for 2 years, you see. The Fed has been selling treasuries into the market in order to raise money to pay for the $1 trillion annual deficits under Trump. At the same time, they've been selling off their balance sheet of the QE balance sheet. They've been selling it off to raise money to handle the deficits, right? So they've been sucking liquidity out of the market, creating a supply shortage out of the repo market. In other words, the deficits in debt and the selling off of the balance sheet by the Fed that had accumulated $4.5 trillion in the last crisis, right? That's been sucking money out of these markets. Well, less supply. Well, prices go up, right? Interest rates go up. Interest rates just the price of money, that's all. Well, now it's beginning to get a little clearer what's going on here. And the new explanation, or a new explanation, it has to do with the demand side in the repo market. In other words, it may be that there's a shortage of liquidity in the repo market because there's so much borrowing by banks, demand for money by banks going on. Well, the banks may be borrowing money not simply to loan to each other, but to reinvest somewhere else. I think this is part of what's going on with the redirection of money capital in general to financial asset markets, stocks and bonds and so forth, derivatives, etc. And the problem in the repo market is complicated by the fact that the traditional regulated banks like Chase and others have left that market. They've abandoned that market and left it to the shadow banks, you see, and money market funds, a shadow bank, right? It's a $2.3 trillion market, so it's not a small market. And what it appeared this last week is that the big players, the money market fund players, State Street and other money market funds, have said simply that they're not going to buy any more treasuries. They don't want any more treasuries, or they're not going to sell the treasuries back to the Fed. They want to hold on to what they got. Well, why are they doing that? Right? Well, if they sell the treasuries to the Fed's been trying to pump money into the market, by the way. Let me back up here because of the liquidity problem. And so far as plans between now and November, middle of November, to pump $400 billion into this market. Right? How do they pump that money into the market? Well, they buy the treasuries in the market held by the money market funds. Right? You buy the treasuries, right? The money market or the market gets the liquidity, the cash, right? And it sells the treasuries back to the Federal Reserve. It exchanges treasuries for cash, right? But it appears that the money market funds don't want to do that. They don't want to sell. Well, if they don't sell it, then the Fed can't pump more liquidity into the market, can they? Well, why don't they want to sell to the Fed? Why don't they want to sell their treasuries back to the Fed in exchange for cash? Well, because, as they're saying, we would just have to buy treasuries again later. Short term, these are short term, at a lower interest, yield for us. You know, right now we've got was it 2.2% on a 30-year treasury? Well, if we sell our treasuries yielding 2.2% back to the Fed, and then we have to borrow more later on at maybe 1.9, and hold those treasuries, we're losing money. Well, we don't want to sell our treasuries back to you, Federal Reserve. Well, if they don't, how's the Federal Reserve going to put more liquidity into that market? The only way they can do it is by buying and selling treasuries. You see, they're in a catch-22 now. And the problem is not just what the Fed has been doing for 2 years and selling off its treasuries, you know, in its on its balance sheet, you know. That's not the problem. That's the supply problem. The problem now is the demand problem. In other words, the money market funds, the shadow banks that have pretty much taken over the repo market because the commercial banks like Chase have retired from it. You know, these shadow banks, these stabilize everything. You know, they're very dangerous. It was the shadow banks, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, right? Fannie Freddie, all those AIG that caused the last crisis. Well, I don't know. Do we see the next crisis beginning to ferment within the repo market here? Well, we will see. Anyway, to make a long, complex story short, you know, the point I simply want to make is that there's a demand side problem. There's a problem with the banks themselves, the shadow banks, with why we have this instability in the repo market. It's not just the policies of the Federal Reserve, you know, selling off their balance sheet and trying to raise money to pay for the deficit of Trump due to his tax cuts and more spending. It's more complex than that. It's demand side. And there are other financial markets we need to similarly keep an eye on, like leveraged loans, junk bonds, and triple B investment grade bonds and so forth. Okay, so enough on revisiting the repo market. But we need to watch it closely here because the Fed solution doesn't seem to be working. And we're going to have another big crisis here probably at the end of the fourth quarter, that is at the end of December. I want to say a few things before moving on about the GM UAW contract. Been watching this and watching the dynamics of it, what's going on. And as I tweeted last week, it looked like the company, GM Management, was getting desperate. Was going directly to the workers themselves. This is a no-no in union management negotiations. You don't bypass the bargaining team that you're looking at across the table and go directly to the workers and try to sell the deal. I mean, that just makes the union bargaining team, stiffen up, you know, and say, oh, you know, you don't want to negotiate with us. You want to negotiate with the members directly and bypass us and our role. Okay, you know, you want to play that game? You know, we'll play tough, too. It was a desperate move on the part of GM to do that, I thought. I felt at the time that, oh, it's going to have repercussions here in this negotiation. What GM also did was what we call moving the money around in bargaining. I've been in many union contract negotiations, headed them up in my earlier years. And a typical thing when you get towards the end is, management knows how much the total cost of the offer is, and they tweak it and they move the money around. In other words, they will up other areas, give you a little bit more in another area, while they give you a little bit less in another area. They're just moving the money around, you see, and trying to figure out how they can buy votes with this or that group of the workforce. If they're short of votes, you know, they move the money to try to win a few more votes, ratification votes in one area and take a little bit of money away from the other area. A typical management contract. Well, what I saw last week was that the GM, when they went to the workers directly, did just that. They moved the money around, you see. Instead of, I believe, their wage proposal was, I hope I get this right, 3% in the first year, or a lump sum in the first year, with a 3% in the second, and a lump sum in the third or the fourth with a 4%, you know, a combination of 4 years of two lump sums and two direct wage increases. Well, you know, lump sums are cheaper for them, because when they give a lump sum payment for you know, a given year's wage increase, it doesn't get built into their wage rate, you see. And then when you get a higher wage rate on top of that, it would be higher in the second year when you got a wage increase. But because it's a lump sum, it doesn't hit the pay per hour rate, and therefore subsequent years it's not as high. So lump sums are really not the amount, the full amount that they say it is when they sell it to workers. Of course, a lump sum, you know, when you're on strike and you're behind on your bills, when you come back, it's nice to get a lump sum to make up, right, those problems or those losses you had, or those back bills now you got to pay. But another problem with a lump sum is when you get a lump sum, you, the worker, has to pay more taxes on it, right? Because it's usually, you know, $9,000-$10,000 in the case of this negotiations. Well, you know, they moved the money around here. They switched the years with the lump sums and the straight wage increases, put a little bit more up front. You know, they're trying to buy some votes with that. A good example of moving the money around. And of course, they held the union held on to the fact that the workers would not pay more than 3% of their salary or their wage for health benefits, right? Well, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, you're not going to pay more in health costs. It just means it's just going to be 3%. So you're going to pay more if your wages go up. It's not as if they've held the line on raising wage costs. A big thing about it is, though, that the proposals, it doesn't look like they've given the union any real assurances about plant closures. They GM had already announced 4 plants they were going to close, and no assurances on not moving work to Mexico. So, you know, and Trump's trade deal with Mexico, you know, no limits on exports, auto exports from Mexico to the U.S. No tariffs on that. You know, in terms of job security, it's not very clear whether GM's going to pay more and then pay that more for fewer workers, right? Make up that money. It looks like they're getting so much per worker, but when you reduce the number of workers, send them to Mexico or whatever, the cost of the company is much less, you see. And the other big area is part-timers. I mean, temps. You know, they've brought a lot of temps into the industry, pay them about half the price. I think the average temp wage rate, or maybe it's the starting wage rate, I don't know, in GM is $17 an hour. $17 an hour. Wow. You imagine trying to live on $17 an hour? And they keep these people as temps for years. They become, in effect, permanent employees, but they're paid for at the lower tier temp rate, and they don't get as many benefits and so forth. I believe GM has announced you can become permanent after 3 years of being a temp. 3 years of being a temp, then you will become permanent. Well, you know, GM can get around that easy. You know, they work 2.5 years and they lay them off and they bring a new temp on, right? And they just keep recycling the temps that way. And that's how they avoid converting someone who's been there 3 years as a temp into a full-time worker. You know, this two-tier thing is devastating for the union. They got to get rid of that. Really splits the workforce. And you can see them, the GM using it to split the workforce in negotiations. They upped the lump sum ratification bonus for full-time workers, I think, from $9,000 to $11,000. But they didn't up it for temps, right? They're thinking that, this path to full-time status is good enough for the temps. Well, to make a story short here, now apparently GM and the union have come to a tentative deal. What does that mean? That simply means that the union will put it before its membership for a vote. That's all. It appears to me that the union bargaining team is not recommending this. Well, why are they putting it to a vote then if they aren't recommending? I may be wrong there. Maybe they are recommending this, but I did not see in the press summaries that the union is recommending this for a ratification. In other words, vote this up. This is very important, if so. Why? Because it's kind of a signal to its membership saying, we don't like this deal either, to enable us to go back to the bargaining table and tell them, see, it's not good enough, you guys got to vote it down. You see, there's a difference between submitting a vote with a recommendation and submitting a vote with no recommendation. The latter is just a signal, vote it down, folks, so we can show them what they offered is not good enough, and we can try to squeeze some more off of them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they recommend it, then they're really saying, this is the best we can get. We can't get any more. Mm-hmm. Also, in the voting, it appears that the union is not, maybe purposely, describing the details of the plant shutdowns. That's going to worry, the rank and file when it comes to voting. And if they haven't, that's probably purposeful. They want to create among the voting members, wait a minute, we don't know whether this is going to mean our jobs or not. I don't like that. We got to get more clarification. So the union bargainers are kind of giving another signal, I think, to their voting workforce there, membership, that this thing isn't all that good. Think about it. And, of course, the temp track to full-time is not all that clear. And it's not so clear what they're going to do with the promise of the vague promise that they would start an electric truck manufacturing plant. So by not recommending and leaving things vague, they're kind of saying, vote it down, folks, and we'll go back to the table. I think that's quite possible. Now, on the other hand, the company is really throwing money in front of them to get them to take the money and run, the ratification bonus and then the lump sum payment. And then, you still get some raises and lump sums in subsequent years. It's a big money enticement, especially when you've been out a month, not to grab that money and run. But that's what GM wants them to do so that GM can continue with its practice of two-tier temps and with its practice of moving more production to Mexico. GM, by the way, is the auto company that has most offshore production compared to the others, Ford and Chrysler and others. what it looks like is that GM's trying to dangle some bucks in front of him, get him to take it and run, and then do what it wants with plant closures and shutdowns, and in other words, recoup the cost. Now, you know, you can agree to raise wages by 4% for 50,000 workers, but if by the second or third year you only got 40,000, you haven't given them 4%. You know, you've given them maybe somewhere around 2.5 to 3%. These are the games you can play with the numbers in collective bargaining. Been through that many times, and it's pretty clear what might be going on here. We'll see whether the membership of the UAW falls for it, grabs the money and runs and pays for it later. But if it's not being recommended, then, you know, indirectly, their bargaining team is saying, don't vote it up. Let's go back to the table. Well, we'll see what happens there. We'll see what happens. Okay, so that's my analysis, and we'll probably have some further clarification on this GM-UAW negotiation even further by next week. I want to talk a little bit about my book coming out, Neoliberalism, The Scourge, Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. You know, and I'll be putting on my blog and website, by the way, in a couple of days, an icon where people can purchase the book at discount through PayPal, in other words, through PayPal. But, you know, one of the things I try to do in this book is to criticize previous analyses of what neoliberalism is. First of all, I think it's a bad term, right? Neoliberal. Liberal. What's liberalism? What's classic liberalism? Well, classic liberalism was really about how markets, we should rely on markets, right? Markets are efficient. And all that means we got to get rid of deregulations, or get rid of regulations. And all we got to privatize public works and production and so forth, right? This is liberalism, classical liberalism. Well, neoliberalism is not about that, you see. It's not liberal at all. So why are they using that term, neoliberal? And who created that term? Well, you know, I spent some time in the first chapter going back and looking at the 1970s and before. These were conservative economists who threw up this term to use liberalism as a kind of justification for these new policies, which were decidedly not liberal. And in the first chapter, I go back and I compare classical liberalism, Adam Smith, David Hume, and some of these others, who are the classic liberals, right? And show that even classic liberalism did not believe that markets were efficient at all times and all places, did not believe that there shouldn't be some regulation, did not believe that free trade should be everywhere and anywhere, and that government should not have any role in the economy. If you go back and you read these works, you can see that it's not what the neoliberals say liberalism is about. Look, I teach a course every spring at St. Mary's College Economics Department in which we just read the three great books of economics, right? We read Adam Smith, we read Karl Marx, and we read Keynes. Right? And every year I reread those books and I see something deeper and more clarifying in each one every time you read them. And I'll tell you, classic liberalism is not about free markets to an extreme. It's not about markets are efficient. It's not about anti-government intervention. It's not about all these things that neoliberalism, which was created in the 70s, really, by very conservative economists to justify the policies that were beginning to come online in under Reagan and under Thatcher. Actually, it begins under Jimmy, in the late 70s. Okay, so you got to distinguish between neoliberalism, the idea, and neoliberalism in practice. What is neoliberalism in practice? It's four policies, a particular mix of four policies: industrial policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy, and trade external policy, as we call them. Right? It's a particular combination of those, which were designed to put U.S. capitalists back in the driver's seat for decades more to come after the crisis of the 1970s. And it did just that. Reaganomics is the beginning, and it evolved, continued to evolve, those four policies in a certain combination. But in the book, I argue that combination, those policies, neoliberalism hit a wall in 2008-09. Obama could not restore it. He failed at doing it. And Trump should be viewed as an attempt to restore neoliberalism in a new, aggressive, virulent form, though, to restore those four policy areas: fiscal policy, and those tax cuts for business, spending on defense, cutting social programs, letting deficits and debt rise. That's fiscal policy. Monetary policy, keeping interest rates chronically low and keeping the value of the dollar low as a result. Trade policy, attacking other capitalists to ensure the U.S. Capitalists get a bigger share, continuing share of the pie. Industrial policy, yes, deregulation, but destroy unions and keep wages compressed, and a whole bunch of other policies relating to health care and pensions and so forth. This is the particular policy mix, but it hit a wall in 2008-09, and Trump's trying to restore it. But I predict he's not going to succeed in restoring it for a whole number of reasons, because in my analysis, I look at what I call the material forces that are deep and behind both the origins of neoliberalism in the 70s and 80s, and now that are undermining the neoliberal consensus and neoliberal policies, which aren't working anymore and will work even less and less. And we are approaching another crisis in 2020, and that will undermine it even further. And what comes after will not be neoliberalism. Okay, we'll pick this up again in more detail next week when we talk about neoliberalism, the scourge from Reagan through Trump. Screaming now.